We're continuing from verse 9. It was the introduction, verse 1, 2, and 3, a picture of the goal, the obstruction of pride in verses 4 to 8. Then Raghunath Das Goswami sort of unpackaged the different consequences of pride or independence, of actually our leaving Krishna behind. And having overcome those obstacles, then once again he actually focuses on the spiritual attainment and the more developed practices that help us to achieve that spiritual attainment. So let's start with verse 9. Marishanatvati Vrajavipina Chandram Vrajavani Swarim Tannatvati Tadatula Sakitve Tularitam Vishakam Shikshali Vitarana Gurutva Priyasharo Girindro Tatprekshala Litarati Tatve Smaramana. Now I'll just go back to verse 8, because although he is talking about breaking the wickedness of rascal me, But there was an interesting, the second part was very interesting. Das Goswami was saying that, so he will mercifully break the wickedness of rascal me, so he'll give me the splendid nectar of transcendental love, and so he will engage me in Sri Radha's service, O mine, with words choked with emotion, worship Lord Giridhari here in Braj. So this is quite a unique concept, this idea of Krishna engaging us in Srimati Radharani's service. And this is the unique feature of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, of the followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and our Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharyas, is that they place emphasis on being the servants of the servants of Lord Krishna in a way that they pray to Krishna to get the service of Srimati Radharani. Everyone is engaged in Goloka Vrindavan, everyone serves Srimati Radharani. The overall picture of Goloka, or the theme of Goloka, is based around Radha and Krishna's pastimes. Whether that be Mother Yashoda or the cowherd boys or the cows or everybody else. So that becomes just like in a drama. Then there's many people who are playing different roles, but ultimately there's like a main theme, there's a main plot. So what's the main theme of Goloka? The main theme of Goloka is Radha and Krishna's romantic affairs. And all of the other parts are sort of subplots and subthemes which facilitate that. So in that sense, everyone is serving Srimati Radharani. Why? Because of, we've been repeatedly mentioning Das, Das, Anudas. The idea is always to become the servant of the servant. And the best servant is Srimati Radharani. Now, amongst the different relationships that exist in Goloka, the relationship of Madhurya relationship, or the loving relationship, the relationship between gopis and Krishna, is one. And here, in this concept of engaging in Sri Radha service, for the most part, not exclusively, but generally speaking, there are two primary relationships that are emphasized in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's preaching, that of being a associate or a servant of Lord Balaram or Lord Nityananda, and that of being a servant of Srimati Radharani. So either the friendship relationship or the conjugal relationship. Of course, all of them are all there, but Kaviraj Goswami begins, Anuto Jvarasas Sabhakti Shriyam. That Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's, one of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's missions and teaching is to actually introduce this conjugal relationship, or to make more known that relationship, was because of its confidential nature, had actually been more or less hidden. All of the other relationships, at least friendship, parental, and conjugal, they have been not cultivated. They've not been cultivated so much and publicized. The general understanding of relationship with Krishna was that of servitude, that everyone's a servant of Krishna. However, this had been, and especially Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was personally absorbed in this relationship in Radha Krishna Parivrikti Aladini Shakti Rasmad, in the mood of Srimati Radharani, especially in Puri at night. And his other associates, Swarup Damodar, Ramananda Roy, Raghunath Das Goswami, they're also in that mood of gopis assisting Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Gadadhar Pandit with Srimati Radharani himself. So Krishna was trying to taste what are the specific loving moods that Radharani experiences. So this idea that it's better to serve and be engaged in the service of Srimati Radharani than the service of Krishna, or rather the best way to serve Krishna is to serve Srimati Radharani, and actually not engaging in a direct relationship with Krishna, but being actually her servant, or the word is used as maidservant. So here Raghunath Das Goswami was saying that a devotee prays to Krishna, let me be a servant of Srimati Radharani. Now, we'll get on to this verse 9. I was just to sort of hone in on the direction things are going in. Mind, meditate on the moon of Braja Forest as the lord of my queen, the queen of Braja Forest as his mistress, Lalita as their peerless friend, Vishakha as the guru who teaches them many things, and Radhakund and Govardhan Hill as two places, the mere sight of which gives charming transcendental love. So here he gives a direction of meditation. Who is Krishna? He's the moon of Braj. But he is the lord of my queen. And who is the queen of Braj? Srimati Radharani. She is his mistress. The perspective of this is sort of displayed in a anecdote which took place at Radhakund in Bhaktisanta Saraswati Thakur's time, when many Vaishnavas have at the present and had at that time had their ashrams there at Radhakund. And one of the Vaishnav kings was actually there also, and he was doing Dandavat Parikrama around Radhakund. And the devotees were pointing out how this was a sign of his humility, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur acknowledged that. But he pointed out, yes, but he's off worshipping Radhakund because he considers Srimati Radharani to be Krishna's beloved. But we worship Radhakund and we worship Srimati Radharani, or we worship Krishna as Srimati Radharani's beloved. In other words, for us, everything rotates around Srimati Radharani, not around Krishna. So here you see that he's making this point, that meditate on the moon of Braj as the lord of my queen. Yes, we serve Krishna and we view Krishna as Srimati Radharani's beloved. Srimati Radharani, yes, Srimati Radharani is Krishna's mistress. So it's a perspective. It's fine-tuning in the way that we talk about, yes, we are Krishna's eternal servants. What does that mean? So we discussed, well, The direction of Gauri Vaishnava is not Vaikuntha, as was pointed out earlier. It's not Ayodhya, it's not Dwarka, but it's Vrindavan. All right, and in Vrindavan, what's the perspective of serving Krishna in Vrindavan? That you serve Krishna through Srimati Radharani. So he's emphasizing this. But of course, they're not alone. They have their assistants, and the most prominent of those is Lalita and Vishakha, who are actually Kaya Vyuha, it's called. They are the expansions of Srimati Radharani's Kaya, means body. So they're her bodily expansions. This is described early on in Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the fourth chapter of the Adilila. The Lakshmis, the Gopis, the queens, they're all different expanses of Srimati Radharani. In the same way that there are countless incarnations, Vishnu Tattva, who are expansions of Lord Krishna, and he is Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam. So Srimati Radharani is Radha Stu Shakti Swayam. She's the original Shakti. And from her, all other Shaktis expand. We are Jivas. We're discussing that sometime earlier with the talks. We're Jivas, and there's a distinction between us and the Shaktis. So Shakti is a different potency. We're marginal potency. And when we go back to the spiritual world, we remain marginal potency. But the difference is that the marginal potency becomes empowered by both the Ladini and the Samvit potencies, by the pleasure potency and the knowledge potency. Of course, existence, we're already existing, Sandini potency. And by that empowerment, that is what it means to become Krishna conscious. That means when you get Krishna prema, those are the potencies that then empower the living entity. And then we have the opportunity to actually directly serve and associate with Krishna's eternal associates. And, all right, and even more specific, that Krishna's favorite places and the best place to serve them is Radhakund and Govardhan Hill. So it's a fine-tuning of this concept of Nitya Krishna Das, in which one should not try to artificially jump into those realms. At the same time, one should know about them. That's why we hear about them. Just like at a certain point, when children approach puberty, they find out that the stork didn't bring them. That doesn't mean that all of a sudden they should start experimenting with sex life, with intimate exchanges. But rather, that should wait at a later time until they get married. But still, there are certain times when you know things so that your perspective on life becomes clearer, even though you don't necessarily practice those things. So that's why we're hearing about these things. Verse 10, he says, Ratim Gauri Lili Api Tapati Sundarya Kirana Sachi Lakshmi Satya Paribhavati Shobhagya Balanaya Vasikara Chandravali Mukhanavina Vrajasati Kshipatara Dhyattam Hari Daitaradham Vajumana. Mind, now we're continuing to direct our mind, worship Lord Hari's beloved Radha, who with the splendor of her beauty makes Rati, Gauri, and Leela burn with envy, who with the power of her good fortune defeats Sachi, Lakshmi, and Satyabhama, and with her ability to control Krishna completely eclipses Chandravali and other pious young girls in Braj. So now the focus becomes Srimati Radharani, some description about her. One is how beautiful she is. Rati, Gauri, Leela, these are other. Rati means the wife of Kamadev, of Cupid. Gauri is Lord Shiva's. So these are very beautiful ladies. Why is there an emphasis on beauty? Does beauty really count? It does in the sense that when you know that there is a connection between love and beauty. I'm just remembering Srila Prabhupada way, way, way back, sometime in the 40s or something like that, wrote one of his BTG articles, "Is the Truth Always Beautiful?" And there was some newspaper article was saying that the truth isn't always beautiful, but Srila Prabhupada was emphasizing, no, actually truth and beauty are connected, because Krishna is the absolute truth and he's the most beautiful. And of course, absolute truth also includes love. So love manifests in beauty as one becomes more and more loving, or the greater the love that one has towards Krishna, that love manifests in the beauty of one's transcendental features. And because Srimati Radharani is the most beautiful, is the greatest lover of Krishna, therefore she's the most beautiful personality. So, and then all of these other demigoddesses that are mentioned here, says that when they see Srimati Radharani, although they rarely get to see her, but sometimes, for instance, during the Rasa dance, it's described how the demigoddesses were watching from above, from their airplanes. And that when they see her, or they see a picture of her, because they do, they don't have photographs, but they have good artists who make pictures of Srimati Radharani, then they become envious. Of course, they become transcendently envious. They're spiritually advanced persons, but they recognize how beautiful Srimati Radharani is and her power of a good fortune defeats Sachi, Lakshmi, Satyabhama, and once again, this is Indra's wife, Lord Narayan's wife, Krishna's wife in Dwarka. They're very fortunate. Very fortunate means they're both goddesses of fortune, and of course they have the opportunity to be in the association of the Lord or his servant, to have unlimited comforts, facilities, but nothing compares to the good fortune of Srimati Radharani. Prabhupada in Nectar of Devotion points out that the ankle bells that the gopis wear are more valuable than, for instance, all the Vaikuntha planets combined. Their ankle bells are made of a certain type of Chintamani gem that's not found anywhere else, and that is more and more valuable. This sort of concept of just imagine, here we are in this room trying to stay warm with this cold wind blowing outside. Trees have no leaves, they have no flowers. Even when they do, they're of quite limited value. And when in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Sanatana Goswami is explaining these different realms that Gop Kumar goes, heavenly planets, that like, you know, are so much beyond anything that we experienced here, and then to actually go up to Brahma Loka, and then beyond Brahma, or go up to the realm of where Bhrigu and all of the saints are actually living, and then Brahma Loka, and then Brahma Jyoti, also what to speak of all the coverings of the universe, and these become progressively more and more opulent, more and more inconceivable, more and more indescribable. And so when he gets to Goloka, it becomes, anyway, it's beyond description. Ultimately, you can only experience it. So what we look for in terms of enjoyment, just like people here, they think, well, let's go to, who knows, Hawaii or somewhere else for a winter vacation to get a little break because it's relatively a more beautiful place. But all of these places are so many unlimited times more extraordinary than when we are now that it really makes you appreciate the power of Maya when we think that we're okay over here and this is a place where we're going to have a good time. So in any case, Srimati Radharani's good fortune defeats all of these, and ultimately, he says, her ability to control Krishna completely eclipses Chandravali and all the pious young girls in Braj. The only thing that controls Krishna is love. Nothing else. And according to the degree of love that you have, to that degree, Krishna is controlled. And because Srimati Radharani's love is of topmost, Krishna is fully under her control. No one else controls Krishna as fully as she does. And here's the last verse. Samam shirupena smaravibhasa radha girivito rajesakshat seva lapanavideye tadgana yujo tadijakya dhyana shravanam nati panchamritamidam jhana nitya govardhanam anudinam pambajamana. Mind, in order to attain the direct service of the lovers of Sri Radha Girithari, who are surrounded by their friends, every day you must drink with Sri Rupa Goswami. This is now a summary. He's already taken us to Braj, Radhakund, the Govardhan Hill, Krishna, Srimati Radharani. Now he says, how are you going to attain that direct service? So he says, every day you must drink with Rupa Goswami the five nectars of worshipping them. So what are these five nectars that are compulsory for all devotees? Jalapta, are you with us? The five nectars of worshipping them. You worship every day you must drink with Srila Rupa Goswami. In other words, follow what you read in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. With Rupa Goswami, the five nectars of worshipping them, Radha and Krishna, chanting their names, we chant Hare Krishna, meditate on them, means hear about them and remember those things instead of other things, hearing about them, bow down before them. These are the five things. So regularly Vaishnavas should, according to how Rupa Goswami has taught us, we should chant their names, worship them, meditate on them, hear about them, bow down before them. And every day you have to worship Govardhan Hill. That's a sixth. So Das Goswami concludes his advice to us, advice to the mind, that if we really want to do this, and then we should let's see these things. So we need to be very clear about what are Rupa Goswami's instructions. Nectar of devotion, nectar of instruction. These two books devotees need to then study, because you can't just do it anyway. You have to do it that way. That's why we are Rupanugas. So we worship them. Do we worship Radha and Krishna? Well, for instance, here we're worshiping Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So just be clear that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Radha and Krishna. And then, yes, we're worshiping them. We chant their names. We do kirtan. We do japa. So, of course, how we chant their names, our absorption, our meditation. I don't even want to talk about being awake, because that's not even chanting Hare Krishna. Struggling either sleeping or trying to stay awake. Meditating on them. Meditating means you remember what you've heard and you meditate on them. But when we take prasadam, that's what we're saying. Now we're going to meditate on Radha and Krishna when we take prasadam. So of course, from taking prasadam to getting in the car and driving and so many other things, we have an opportunity and we meditate on and hearing about them of what we've heard. So we have books. Srila Prabhupada has given us these books. We have Srimad Bhagavatam. It doesn't mean that you exclusively just target at that. But certainly devotees should hear about Srimati Radharani and Krishna's pastimes, bowing down before them. So for instance, if Mana, Radha Gokulananda there, here again, here's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we're down, bowing down before him. And every day you must worship Govardhan Hill, which is an interesting thing. He just puts this here. Either you worship Govardhan Hill as you worship a Govardhan Shila, or devotees can worship Govardhan Hill by mentally bowing down to him, by mentally doing parikrama to Govardhan. That's something that one can do when they're doing japa, just like when you're in Vrindavan and go around Govardhan Hill and you chant japa. So similarly, when you chant japa, you can go around Govardhan Hill. This is actually the facility that the mind gives. This is what we're meant to be using our mind for. Sometimes the question is it right? Well, what's better? Meditating on parikrama of Govardhan Hill when you're chanting japa, or meditating on a host of unmentionable things that we've done in the past? So yes, that's what it means to fix our mind. So Raghunath Das Goswami is really, these are real sutras. They're condensed information which we can discuss, we can consider ourselves, analyze, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, without guile. We should study and practice these things without guile. And one way of entering more into this Manashiksha is by regularly reading it. Now, sometimes Vaishnavas read these things on a daily basis. You can't read everything on a daily basis. But there are different books until you actually have really sort of imbibed, feel that you really understand it, and then see, all right, now what part of these things am I already practicing? And when I'm practicing and I'm doing it with the real proper mood, the proper bhav, and the proper way, what things am I not doing that I should just incorporate into my Krishna consciousness, into my daily sadhana? And then, of course, one may go on to some others. It's like, maybe next time I come, these are 10 vows. They're called Sri Swaniyama Dashaka. What are the vows that Vaishnavas take in the execution of devotional service? Now, aside from our vows of chanting 16 rounds or following the four regulative principles, but fine-tuning that, and then here again, Raghunath Das Goswami fine-tunes that. For instance, he says, I vow I shall love my spiritual master, the Gayatri Mantra, the holy name of Lord Krishna, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's feet, Sarav Damodara Goswami, Rupa Goswami, his associates, his elder brother Sanatana Goswami, Govardhan Hill, Radhakun, Mathura City, Vrindavan Forest, the land of Braj, the devotees of Lord Krishna, and the residents. Braj says, I vow that I shall live in the land of Braj birth after birth, chatting casually with the villagers. I shall not live even for a moment in any other place, even if the Lord resides there in his deity form, and even if the great devotees fill it with the sweet nectar of transcendental love. In other words, either you're living physically in Vrindavan or mentally in Vrindavan, but don't depart from it from a moment. And there are so many other... Here's one, a very beautiful verse. I'll just read it. It gives you sort of a perspective on devotees' faith and commitment to Krishna. Anadir, sadir, vaktura, tim, yirdu, vaktipada, pramila, karunya, pagudna, karuna, hina, itiva, and so on. He says, beginningless, or with a beginning, cruel, or very gentle, merciful at every moment, or merciless, greater than the king of Mahavaikuntha, or an ordinary human being. The son of Braja's king is my lord, birth after birth. Anyway, that's for another time, if you remind me next year. So then, as we've been reading every time, Raghunath Das Goswami then gives the false duty of this Manashiksha. In other words, he gives his blessings. He's an eternal associate of Lord Krishna and Srimati Radharani. He's one of Srimati Radharani's maidservants. His name is Rati Manjari. Rati means love. So he's more or less the personification of love for Srimati Radharani. Just like Rupa Goswami is also Rupa Manjari, and he's the personification of Rupa Goswami's beauty. So a person who stays with the devotees, number one, follows Sri Rupa Goswami. You notice that he's really emphasizing this, that you have to do things in the line of Rupa Goswami. And with a sweet voice, sings aloud these 11 excellent instructions to the mind. Sweet doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be melodic. Sweet means that it's with feeling, with appreciation, which grant all spiritual benedictions. So it's very interesting that these are not just instructions of what to do, but the instructions in themselves give the empowerment to achieve those things. But you really have to identify with them and connect with them. We'll give all spiritual attentions, we'll attain the matchless jewel of direct service to Shri Radha and Krishna in the forest of Gokula. So if we practice Manashiksha, if we hear it, if we apply it in our own spiritual lives, and of course, as he says here, if we chant it repeatedly, then ultimately we will attain that type of perfection or success that's being described here, which means that the mind becomes a mirror for its purified heart, and it becomes the means which actually helps us enter into the spiritual realm. So Krishna explains to Arjuna, Bandur Atmat Manastasya Jainat Mayavat Manajita Anatmanastu Shatrutve Bharate Atmaiva Shatruba. He says the mind can be the friend of the living entity and his enemy. When the mind is uncontrolled, it becomes the enemy. When the mind is controlled, it becomes the friend. So in the way that our minds now spontaneously bring up all kinds of thoughts of past experiences in this life and in many other lifetimes, just by force of habit, as we first control the mind, and after as we purify the heart, the mind will just automatically, it's like a mirror. Whatever you put in front of the mirror, it just reflects. The mind will just automatically reflect all the things that you read, all the things that you hear. In other words, becomes a friend. It just reflects Krishna's pastimes, it reflects his qualities, it reflects the Maha Mantra. If there's nothing bad within the heart, then there's nothing for the mind to reflect, nothing bad for the mind to reflect. But in the meantime, in between the two, there has to be control. In between being a slave of the mind and the mind being your servant, it has to be brought under control. And it can only be brought under control by very strong spiritual practice. So Krishna concludes the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. He says that if the intelligence is fortified by very strong spiritual practice, then it can control the mind. That way the senses become controlled. And by the good spiritual practices, then as the heart becomes purified, the straying nature or the mind to go astray decreases, ultimately comes to nil. But you have to do things the right way. Otherwise, if the heart isn't pure, then you end up struggling with an unruly mind life after life after life. Manashiksha. So here are nice instructions to the mind. We're at 8:45. Okay, any quick questions before we're heading off to Prasadam, Krishnami?
Before Rupa Goswami said we should listen to these instructions.
means without duplicity, without false interpretation, without hesitation. In other words, we really need to be clear on Rupa Goswami's teachings, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's line comes in that direction. And then there are many acharyas and many teachers, but their teachings differ from ours, and they give a different type of... You follow Ramanuj, you follow Madhavacharya, you get a different destination. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu only wrote Shikshashtaka, but Rupa Goswami has unpacked Shikshashtaka, and everyone else, all the acharyas, Raghunath Das Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, they're also all followers of Rupa Goswami.
Maybe we should
a little louder.
You were mentioning that with material attachments, Krishna brings you to breaking point, then to breaking point, or he takes the attachments away, forcing them. And then I was wondering, well, why would Krishna, if Krishna's only going to give you whatever you want, then why would he force you to give up attachments? And you just say, well, if that's what you want.
Because when Krishna favors the devotee on the basis of service, and he sees that the devotee still has petty attachments, then he will fulfill those attachments, but fulfill them in a way that devotees no longer want them. That's one thing. Another is that you break in the material world one way or another. So he's saying this world, he'll break this rascal me. In other words, either the material energy will break you, or Krishna forces us to surrender. And then if we don't surrender, then material energy will break. So of course Krishna doesn't take away our free will. But still, when Krishna wants something, he really puts pressure on. And then either you... To get away from that pressure, you can take shelter of the material energy, but that's all the material energy does to us life after life. It keeps breaking us. Except that we're foolish, and then we keep coming back for more. So, when a devotee prays to Krishna, yes, please break, then he's surrendering to Krishna, he's praying to Krishna, whatever it takes, just take away these material attachments. Sometimes it's very difficult for us to get rid of them. But if a devotee actually really wants, then Krishna will do that. If a devotee doesn't want, like I said, if Krishna is very favorable, then in another strategic way, Krishna will arrange things in such a way that a devotee will give it up. But when a devotee prays to Krishna, yes, please assist me, because I have difficulty on my own in becoming free from such and such bad habits, and especially for entering into spiritual realms, then Krishna will respond to that. So like he says, the highway wind got me bound by the neck, so just call out to Krishna and he will save you.
Guru Maharaj, you mentioned quite a few translations of Manasa Sita. One led by Sadhu Brahma. He mentioned that you can give up everything, pride, lust, envy, greed. And I think he mentions, I don't know if it's correct or not, but the text 7, that everything can be given up, but ahankar, false ego, that's the most difficult thing. Is that correct? I mean, that's the sort of translation.
Well, those are probably commentaries. What he did, those are Bhakti Vinod Thakur and Bhakti Stanta's commentary. Of course, false ego, we have an ego. You can't give up your ego. You can just change it. And that's why we're trying to change our ego from being Maya Das to being Krishna Das. And that ego changes as our You know, what does ego mean? It's what you're identifying with. So we're identifying with this body and so many other things because of our conditioning. But as the heart becomes purified, then our conditioning changes. We become conditioned to identify with Krishna, and our ego, our actual swarup, our natural constitutional ego as Krishna's servant becomes manifest. So you can't just throw off your ego, but actually have to purify it. Because ego means that it's our identity, it's the soul. It's a question of what the soul is identifying with.
One of the verses that you read out, Raghunath Das Goswami, was saying that he wouldn't be satisfied in living in any other place other than Vrindavan, even if the Lord resides there in his deity form. So we understand that wherever Krishna resides, even in the form of the deity, then that place is Vrindavan. So is it enough to be satisfied living in a temple like this, or should we still aspire to actually...
But you need to be in Vrindavan. So the deity may be there, and it may be the deity of Lord Narayan, it may be the deity of Lord Krishna. Krishna also lives in Dwarka and so on. But the deity is only in Vrindavan, or you're only in Vrindavan when your consciousness is there. So that's why when Prabhupada is translating in Nectar of Instruction that one should always live in Vrindavan, he says either one should physically live there, or if you can't, you have to mentally live there. So we, rather than having the identity, I'm living in Les Mahego, we decorate our houses, we decorate the temple in such a way as to reflect that I'm living in Vrindavan. And of course, that's also a type of cultivation. But the more that we hear about Vrindavan and the more that we use things to remind us, why do we have these pictures on the wall? Are they just there to say that there's something somewhere else, or there to actually remind us that this is where we want to be, and by wanting to be there, that's where we are. Because wanting to be in a transcendental place and being in a transcendental place are more or less synonymous. So it's just a matter of time. So if we're in this consciousness that we're even trying to remind ourselves that yes, our home is Vrindavan, we want our residence to be in a place of Vrindavan, and our consciousness is in Vrindavan, because that's what Krishna consciousness means. So Krishna aware. Krishna's not just walking around on clouds, we're talking about Krishna in Vrindavan. Then, that doesn't mean that, you know, the deity of Krishna is there, Radha and Krishna is there, yes, there's Vrindavan. But if we're not in Vrindavan, that's why, for instance, in New Vrajadhama, I tried to make different holy places and so on to remind the devotees that they are in Vrindavan, because if they don't think that they're in Vrindavan, then they won't be. And even the residents in Bona Vrindavan, if they're not acting and thinking in the way that they're in Vrindavan, and if they're not behaving like that, then in this life they're not going to get the benefit of going back to Krishna. What they will get by the special power of Vrindavan is that they'll get born some kind of animal in Vrindavan, and in their next life they'll go back to Krishna. So it's our awareness and consciousness, appreciation of where we are, which is very important. And that's why this whole concept of mana shiksha, giving instruction to the mind and engaging our mind properly to be a vehicle that helps us actually always think of, when we're thinking of Krishna, we're thinking of Vrindavan and identifying as being residents of Vrindavan. Just like Prabhupada said in 1966, he was there, I'm here in New York, but I'm always hankering after Vrindavan. And the last one.
Just in relation to one of the last things you were saying, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that our mind can be our best friend or our worst enemy. So would it be true to say that the only enemy we have is the
Well, there are, yeah. I mean, I think there's a statement to that effect. Obviously, the bad habits within our heart are also our enemies. Our uncontrolled senses are also enemies. But certainly when the mind is under control, then these things become much easier to deal with. But just like if you have, you have an enemy kingdom, and if the king is your enemy, then all of his soldiers and citizens are your enemy. But if the king is under control and he's your friend, then you don't have to worry about the rest of the kingdom. So the mind is really sort of the pivotal point. And that's what we need to engage in Krishna consciousness. That's why we're forcibly keeping our senses under control, even though our mind may be giving us some other type of advice. But, and that's why so much emphasis has to be there on our strengthening our intelligence, because ultimately, although you can forcibly restrain your senses for some time, unless the mind really comes under control and the heart becomes purified by good practice, it's like an endless struggle. You're not really getting anywhere. And we see that unless devotees' hearts become purified, and in that way their minds become pacified, they just give in at a certain point. So Krishna consciousness means sadhana bhakti. And unless we're really doing quality sadhana, and as years go by, the quality of our sadhana increases, it becomes like a thankless, it's like a war, it's like First World War. You know, when they got over there to Belgium, they were like, getting nowhere. In 1 year, they went like, they advanced 10 yards this way, and then the Eastern Front went 10 yards this way. And millions of people dying over grain, gaining no ground at all. So that becomes very discouraging. So you've got to be gaining ground as you go along. And that's why it's such an important thing. Study Srila Prabhupada's books, regular morning program, and nicely chanting Hare Krishna, and really being there every opportunity of devotional service. We're right there, we're right absorbed, we're forcing the mind. It's not easy, but that's yoga. And there's no easy alternative. When Krishna tells, Arjuna says it's impossible to control the mind, Krishna didn't say, okay, but here's like a real shortcut. He just says, you're right. It's very difficult. But abhyasena tu kantena vairagena, he says, by constant practice and by detachment, he says these two things, then one can do it. But that practice has to be very effective. So it's a difficult thing, but if we follow our acharyas, then we'll gain mastery over this very unruly, problematic mind. Hare Krishna. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Gaur Nithai ki jai. Jai Nithai Gaur Premanandi ki jai.